welcome to the Lately in JavaScript podcast. I'm Manuel Lemus, the host of this podcast. And as always, I have here with me Michael Kimson.
Hello. Hello. Oh, sorry. Hello.
It's always great to see you happy, probably with the show. So what have you been up to? Oh, I remember you have just gone through your event, IndieConf. How did it go?
It went well, thank you. And we probably won't have another episode about this for a bit, but I'll do a quick recap. Last week we had our IndieConf, which is a conference for web freelancers up in Raleigh, or down in Raleigh, depending where you're coming from. And we had close to, well, I think we had a couple of unticketed people who are our video people, doing audio and video capture of everything. We had just over 100 people there on site, which was pretty exciting for a first event.
Right.
Had a lot of speakers from the Raleigh or the North Carolina area. We had some from outside the area, from Michigan and Florida. And trying to think, we actually had, and I didn't actually catch his name enough, but at the very end I said, who came the farthest? Who attended from the farthest? We had somebody from Michigan, and we had somebody from Atlanta, and there was this rustle in the background, and someone said, this guy's from Brazil.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, so he won a giveaway, a book, the money book, from two of our speakers, and he'd come from Brazil, I think, just for the conference, which was pretty interesting.
Really? All the way, or he was not already living there?
No, he wasn't already living there. He'd come from Brazil. I don't know if he had other business in the area as well, but he'd come from Brazil.
Well, that's great. So now you can call your event international.
It's an internet. Yes, I hadn't thought of that till just now. But yes, that's great.
Yeah. Okay, that's good to know. Any interesting JavaScript related talks you want to comment?
We didn't have any specific JavaScript stuff. We will next time. We had Rebecca Murphy, who is a JavaScript name, lives in the area. She came and presented on Git, which was very well attended. Zoe Gillenwater is fairly well known in the CSS community, and she came and presented on CSS3. We had I had a couple of people that I was going to bring and have them come on JavaScript, and I decided against it early on, but I think the next time we do this event, there's going to be a few more tech tracks.
Right.
That will have things, probably another CSS or something like that, and a JavaScript front-end engineering session.
Right, because the focus is more on soft skills, right, than actual...
A little bit, yeah. But at the same time, there's a lot... The focus is still on web freelancers. And right. Some people are copywriters, and some people are maybe they're programmers and such, but we all have a web focus to us. And I was initially going to have a track or a whole set of sessions on back-end technologies like PHP and .NET and Ruby and so on. But it felt to me that those would be very divisive. Anybody that's going to the PHP one will by definition not go to the .NET one probably the Ruby one. But having a CSS track or session, having JavaScript, maybe one or two on those, I think will be very inclusive, because it doesn't matter if you're doing Ruby or if you're doing PHP or whatever you're doing, you're going to be using JavaScript.
Right. Well, I think for our first event, you had a great audience. I hope next edition sort of open more space for JavaScript, because I'm sure it is sort of a consensual interest of all the tribes, as you mentioned.
It was I hesitate to say a full mistake to not have it, but in retrospect, I wish I had brought in someone specifically for JavaScript. We'll do that next year.
Right. Okay. Oh. So moving on.
Sure.
This month, there is a topic I wanted to comment about, basically related with an article. Well, by the time we are recording, it was not yet published, but it probably be published tomorrow, but once the podcast is in the air, the article is already published for anybody to read. Well, it is basically about XML HTTP request specification that recently has moved on to a new level. As everybody knows, XML HTTP request is often referred to the what powers most AJAX applications, although you don't need to actually use XML HTTP requests. Sometimes you can use iframe-based implementations. Actually, I just mentioned that because in my PHP applications, I use iframes to implement the sort of functionality, AJAX functionality that you have in your web applications. And what is relevant now is that this new level of specification that W3C consortium is organizing adds some new features that overcome limitations of the first version of XML HTTP request. For many years, XML HTTP request was not under any official specification. For those that are not familiar with the whole story, it all started with Microsoft Exchange server that had a product that allowed to have web-based access to the functionality of the server. The idea was to make it more provide the user interface that is more fluent, more interactive. But that was I suppose in 1999, and they had this implementation which is initially was based on a Java applet that then later it moved on to an ActiveX object that would provide that functionality to Internet Explorer 5. And that was the sort of the beginning of what most of us call AJAX, to have these kind of applications that are more interactive because they access the server to send or receive data in the background, thus without having to reload the page. And later in 2002, I think, it was when the first Mozilla browser version was released. It already came with the XML HTTP request object built in that browser. That the Mozilla was actually a suite that consists of several programs, not just a browser, but was basically the grandparent of Firefox, which many of us use now until today. And as I said, in 2002, it added that functionality of having this XML HTTP request object. But I think, at least in my opinion, what really made this use of this object to implement the so-called AJAX application was Gmail. And I think Google Maps too, because those were applications that actually gave great visibility to the object. And those were released only in 2004. So there was a gap until somebody realized the great potential of this object that could work also in non-Microsoft browsers. And later in 2005, Jesse James Garrett coined the AJAX term to refer to this practice of using XML HTTP request or some other technology like hidden iframes, as I mentioned before, to implement the so-called AJAX applications. And for all this period, there was no effort to standardize the specification of the object. The standardization only came in 2006, when finally somebody at the W3 consortium decided to gather and make it a standard specification. More recently, there is a new effort to standardize the next level so-called level 2 of the specification to provide them this better functionalities to overcome the limitations of the original XML HTTP request object. And Michael, I don't know, are you familiar with the new specification?
Vaguely. I mean, actually, I've pulled it up here while you've been talking to look at it and see what it gives. The notion of a being able to trigger progress events and react to progress events seems probably the most immediately useful aspect of this XHR level 2. But mentally, I'm having a bit of a hard time figuring out how that would be how that would be integrated into my current code or right. future code, I should say.
Well, see, this is a new specification, and I think there are some browsers like Firefox 4 and Chrome that already implement at least part of the specified functionality. Actually, the specification is still in draft, so between now and the final specification, things may change, but I think there are a few features that probably will not change. And those that I have studied in this version of the specification, I just would highlight two or three of them. I have to confess that the whole specification is not clear to me what are there some of the features that are described there. But those that got my eye, as in one of them is just like you mentioned, the ability to track progress. For instance, if you are submitting a request to the server, that probably will take a long time. Now it is possible to have callbacks that are invoked when there is new data being sent or received from the server. So you sort can somehow use that those event callbacks to maybe show to the user how much has gone so far and how much remains to be done. And I think this is very useful, and too bad it was not made available before. So as to your question, how you would integrate in your current code, I think you probably have to use some conditional code to detect whether the XML HTTP request object under the current browser supports it or not. So
sure.
It will be something not mandatory. To be an additional feature that you would implement if this support is available, and then fall back to something else, probably doing nothing. If you realize that it's not available. But other than that, also regarding tracking progress, one of the most common use cases of tracking progress is to upload files. Special N files are very long. It would be useful to give the user an idea of how much remains to be done. So
yeah, feels like, well, it is an attempt to standardize, come up with a normal way of doing this, because I've been on projects where we've had to try to come up with our own protocol for figuring out what the status is and doing separate calls to get progress stat on something, and if we're able to do that in a standard way, I think that'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see also what libraries like jQuery and Dojo and YUI and all that, what they offer and how they integrate either new functionality or replace old functionality with the new this level 2 stuff.
Yeah,
that'll be an interesting development to see.
Right. Well, as I was saying, one of the most common use cases for this progress tracking support would be for file uploading, but the problem is that at least until the first version, it was not possible to build file upload requests because HTML HTTP request had no support for building an HTTP request of type post that would attach a file, because you would have to have access to the actual contents of the files. And until recently, it was not possible for JavaScript to have access to the data of the files in the user browser machine.
Yep.
For security reasons, of course. And actually, I was trying to study what is now possible. I'm still not sure, but from what I understand, there is now this file API, which is basically a separate specification that, from what I understood, it allows you some sort of access to the files, probably related with some file input in a form, or another possibility, which I think it's now available on Gmail, which is the ability to drag and drop files from your desktop into the browser.
Yep.
And then you'll be able to upload them.
Interestingly, well, I was playing around with this, the drag and drop specifically. I've seen it for a while, but I did a small thing probably 2 months ago and played with it. I dragged stuff, and it was kind of cool to get access to the data that is in the file that was dragged in. But I've seen it more specifically, thinking about it, I don't know if it's I don't know if it's a Flash thing or not, but I can drag files into Gmail now when I'm composing a mail. I just drag a file in there, and I roll over or mouse over this target with a selected file and drop it, and it acts just like I selected the file, and it starts doing an upload.
Yeah. Well,
I think, but I can't remember now if that's, because for a while some of their uploading stuff was using Flash.
Yeah. Well, for me, I've been using a plugin for I have this forms generation validation package that comes with a plugin that allows you to track progress of uploaded files. What basically it does is that it starts an ENI frame, and that is actually sending a request to the server, and it passes an ENI identifier that PHP is able to recognize as a request going on in parallel, and it can retrieve the information of the file being uploaded. And this plugin works well, but it requires a parallel connection going on at the same time that the actual form submission request is open. And it works well. It gives all the information. It tells the user how much was uploaded so far and how long it will take. It's an estimation of how long it will take until the end. But it would be better if all could be done within a single request. And I think so far, besides any browser that support this feature in the XML HTTP request level 2 object, I think only in Flash you could do it. So this is great. This is one feature that was pretty much in demand. And other than that, another feature that seems to reply to demands of many developers, at least that is my perception, is the ability to do cross-domain XML HTTP requests. I've been talking with the guy from the Opera browser that is leading the specification.
Yeah.
His name is Anne. I'm not sure how to pronounce his
Van Kesteren?
Yeah. You probably would say his name better than me, so I will not try.
Okay.
And according to him, this is probably the greatest feature of XML HTTP request level 2, which is the ability to send cross domain requests. What happens is that when you load a page, it will not allow you to send the JavaScript inside in that page is not allowed to send AJAX requests to other domains for security reasons.
Right.
That could be used to perform cross-site scripting exploits. And but at the same time, there is a demand for to allow this type of cross-domain requests. So what this version and the specification allows is actually specified in a separate document that describes how cross-domain requests should be done. And it basically consists on the server that generates the current page must send a special header that will tell whether or not you can send AJAX requests to separate domains. So I think this will address a need that many developers had and have been requesting it. I think this, for me, these are the most important features from those that I learned from the current draft specification.
Well, I think I'd agree with you that cross-domain one is probably I would agree it's important to you. It's important to me as well, and it's probably going to have the biggest impact as this gets rolled out. Though I'm always a little hesitant when these new features come about because there may not be
available.
The adoption rate. If the adoption rate isn't quick enough, we'll find ourselves writing custom, or not custom, we're writing conditional code. Well, if you're using this browser or if you're using this functionality, then you have this feature. And if you don't, you don't. It's really that's the nature of the web stuff. I understand that's how it has to be. I just hope that a lot of browsers end up supporting or offering this XHR level 2 quickly. It'd be great to have a huge amount of adoption within, say, a year, so we could just start counting on it.
Yeah, well, that's always a drag because
yes,
it does not depend on you, and you have to rely on what you get. So if you want to take advantage of it now, you will always have to write conditional code. Well, the recommended way to do it is not doing browser detection, but rather feature detection. Having some sort of variable or function call that you can detect whether it is present or not, rather than make conditions.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I agree. Feature detection over browser detection. But the reality is that the feature is going to be available in some browsers, and it won't for a while. I'm hoping that time period is pretty short.
Yeah. Well, even if it's not, even if it's short, you will always have to put some conditions in there because there will always be people that will not upgrade to the latest browsers.
There's always going to be a few, but this is selfish, but my view is that if I can demonstrably point to the majority of a client's audience or a client's users are using a particular browser or set of browsers that have certain features available to them, we'll use that. I mean, because at some point you have to have a cutoff, because you could say, well, there's five people out there still using Lynx and it doesn't support JavaScript. That doesn't mean that I don't use JavaScript or that I don't use AJAX because some people are still using Netscape 2. The preponderance of people are going to be using something. If the majority of people by 2012 are using a current Chrome, Firefox 4, Safari 5, Opera 11, and IE8 or higher, for example, or IE9 or higher, that would be fantastic, I think, in terms of modernity in JavaScript and browsers.
Right. Well, one thing that I have not studied yet is what is the state of adoption of this specification so far? Because it's still in drafting. If I'm not mistaken, it was started in 2008 and then sort of they sort of paused it for a while, and then they are resuming it this year. And well, we'll see. Well, yeah. Standard specifications.
I don't, just as a point of principle, I don't go out of my way to even check if something works in IE6 or not. I gave up on that probably a year ago.
Yeah.
And
I no longer have it installed on any machines. So if I wanted to test it, too bad. It's not possible.
Yep.
But I think from what I read, its adoption is probably lower than 3% by now.
So well, this is an interesting topic. Thanks for bringing this up, because I was not aware that there was this level 2 thing actually being spec'd out. I've heard about some of these ideas floating around, but I didn't know what the status of actually bringing it together was. Well, I'm going to keep an eye on this.
Yeah. Well, but moving on with our podcast, the next subject we plan to cover, Michael, you mentioned about this SunSpider benchmark and some discussions regarding Internet Explorer 9 results.
Sure.
What's going
on? Well, I'll introduce this very briefly. I'm not an expert at this at all, but David Calhoun, who is the news editor for JS Mag, does a weekly blog post update. And I think a couple days ago on Friday, he'd done a weekly wrap-up, and one of the things that had come out in the last week or so was someone had accused Microsoft, or specifically the IE9 team of Microsoft, of quote-unquote cheating cheating in their JavaScript engine, because there was a test or a benchmarking test. There's a number of benchmark tests out there. One is called SunSpider, and it's a number. It's a collection of tests that that drive and rate different browsers' JavaScript functionality. And apparently, IE9, whatever the current release version of IE9 is, did very, very well on a particular test. But when the numbers were amazingly fast, but when someone went in and changed one aspect of that SunSpider, that one particular test, like just changed one of the numbers, one of the values in it, IE9's performance went way, way, way down. And the accusation was that they had just optimized and basically cheated and just looked for a certain code in the benchmark, or was just looking for certain code and reacted very, very fastly rather than treating it as normal code, supposedly. There was a bit of a leap, I thought, to make that accusation. And as we were saying before this recording was happening, that I suspect that the IE9 team was simply, not maliciously so, but they were making sure that their code ran very well in those tests and had simply not gone through and made sure that other scenarios work just as well. I may have a very naive view of this, but you know, I don't view Microsoft really as the evil empire as I wouldn't say they're being attacked, but they are being challenged on many, many fronts.
Yeah.
Browsers and mobile devices and gaming and desktop software. They're challenged all over the place.
Right.
And effectively, as I'd said before, they're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't. If they had just put out, here's our latest version of IE9, everybody check it out, and it did really, really poor on the benchmarks, people would have just said, hey, you still suck. You can't put a browser out now. Look at all this other stuff. So they try to make sure that it's competitive, and they're getting taken to task on this. I don't think it was a malicious, hey, we're gonna try to cheat on this. It's too easy for people to find out. So, and I suspect that this wasn't an intentional cheating so much, and they're still being accused of it. So in some cases, in some ways, if we continually still in 2010 and 2012, 15, whatever, if we keep accusing Microsoft of continuing to play dirty all the time, they'll have very little incentive to not do it. Because when you cheat and when you play dirty, you get advantages. And if you're going to be accused of it anyway, you may as well do it.
Right.
So I was just a little sad to see that such an accusation come out.
Right. I think you're right. There will always be people that will find excuses to blame it on Microsoft for whatever reasons. And I also don't think that they did it on purpose. And at the same time, I don't think that matters much, because in the end, in terms of speed, it's the overall feeling that the user gets from the browser, not specifically on a certain benchmark that just tests a limited number of situations. And I think the subject itself probably will not...
On the upside, one of the things, if I remember correctly, or if I understand this correctly, IE9's JavaScript engine is going to much more easily take advantage of multiple processors, a lot more lower level integration. I don't want to say integration in a bad sense, but it's very tied to Windows, and I think they're going through a lot of effort to make sure that it can handle as much computational power as Windows itself can, rather than arbitrarily segmenting it or keeping it locked to one particular CPU. My understanding is that they've been trying to make a lot of progress in the multi-core process, or the multi-core focus. And because they only focus on one platform, that's maybe another potential area for them to dominate it, at least initially, or to lead the way. Though I'm not sure anybody would look and say they're going to take their code. They really can't, unless they offer it up. But maybe there'll be some lessons that people can learn by looking at some of the efforts that they have. No doubt that Chrome and Safari and Firefox and others are looking at multi-core distribution and all that kind of stuff too. But I suspect that Microsoft may have a little bit of a lead there simply because they get to focus on one platform.
Right. I think that's very positive, because I think that is the kind of competition that is healthy, because different browser vendors, developers, are working hard on surpassing the results achieved by others, implementing new techniques that were not implemented before. And basically, we all benefit from that, because whatever browser you prefer, sooner or later your browser vendor or developer will also catch up or try to do even better with some approach that was not tried before. And I think this, I'm not mistaken, this version of IE9 implements some hardware acceleration using the graphics hardware to render whatever graphics are necessary to appear on the pages. And this is good for many types of applications, for instance games that may need to render a lot of graphics on screen. And I also understood that Chrome was already implementing hardware acceleration, and as I said, the overall result will be the benefit for all users, regardless of the browser that you choose, because they're trying to keep up with each other.
Yeah.
Okay, but moving on with our podcast, now I'd like to bring up a book that I have been reviewing. Actually, I published a review just a few days ago. It's a JavaScript cookbook from O'Reilly. O'Reilly is well known for your cookbook book series, if we can call it a series, because the books are not related, are for different languages. But this JavaScript cookbook follows the same pattern, the same quality of that O'Reilly already got us used to. And my overall impression is that it's quite an handy book, because frequently when you need to write JavaScript code, you find yourself trying to solve common situations that if you are fluent in JavaScript, if you program JavaScript every day, you probably would not need, but many of us are web developers, and our main language is the server-side language that you use, being that PHP or Java or C Sharp or Ruby or Python or whatever. And we are not probably as fluent as we could be if we program JavaScript every day. And sometimes we have a need to find a good proven solution for a common problem. Sometimes it just takes a few lines of code to implement it, and you find yourself looking on the web or whatever to see what is that common solution for the problem that you're having. And having a JavaScript cookbook on your desk will sort of shortcut many of your problems, because this book will not cover all the possible situations that you may encounter, but at least it provides solutions for many, many, many situations that will be common. And in the end, I think most of the times you will find a solution for the common problem that you have. Are you familiar with cookbook types of books?
Now, is this who's the author of this book?
Well, as I said, the book is from O'Reilly, and the author is Shelley Powers.
Shelley Powers, okay.
I'm afraid I'm not familiar with her name, probably, but because I, most of the time, as I mentioned, I work in PHP. But my impression is that the book itself provides many, many solutions for common problems that would end up being used for the kind of developer like myself and probably yourself, as most of the time JavaScript is not the language that you program. You end up programming more in your server-side language. And but other than that, there are a few sort of unexpected chapters at the end that got my eye, besides those that cover common topics. And that chapter in particular covers situations that are not so common, but probably sooner or later you have the need to address them in your applications or whatever projects are you having. In that chapter covers the creation of plugins for browsers like Google Chrome or Firefox, and also solutions for creating JavaScript applications for mobile phones. As I mentioned, okay. These solutions are not so common, but I think sooner or later you'll have them. So I think that chapter is an interesting bonus.
Well, this book. Always interesting timing, just like with the regular desktop browsers and all that. For some people, writing JavaScript for mobile browsers is already something that they do, and they do a lot of. But I think it's still very much a niche thing, and it may be by the time particular the majority of people are writing JavaScript for mobile devices, that there may be a whole other level of functionality available in those devices that might not be covered in a book like this. It's just the perennial problem of technical publishing in general. One question for you here in terms of the book, because when you first mentioned it, my mind went to the jQuery cookbook, but no, this is actually the JavaScript cookbook.
Yeah.
Did you find that it kept a focus just on pure JavaScript, or were there references to things like Dojo and YUI and jQuery and stuff like that?
Well,
just pure JavaScript?
Right. Most of the book is for general JavaScript situations. And actually, I think that is probably more useful, at least from my point of view, that because most of the time I I try to avoid using bloated or at least large JavaScript libraries when I just need to something that takes a couple of lines. Nevertheless, there is one chapter that is that one specific chapter in the book that covers the use of libraries, but it talks a bit about jQuery, but obviously it does not focus much on that, because as you mentioned, jQuery itself would be subject of having a whole cookbook for just for it.
Yep. And there is one out there, which I think was done by a collection of authors. I thought I had it here. Where'd it go? jQuery cookbook. Yeah, it says it's by Cody Lindley, but my understanding is there was a number of contributors. Yeah, okay, and the Amazon page is saying here, Remy Sharp, Jonathan Sharp, Ralph Whitbeck, Rebecca Murphy, Mike Hostetler, and it looks like about 20 different people. So, and yet the JavaScript cookbook, it looks like Shelley Powers did everything there.
Yeah, it's
about a single list of contributors. Book. Pardon?
It's a general purpose book, not
sure. I'm not all sorts knocking it at stuff. All. It's just it's interesting to see the two different approaches or multiple approaches in the cookbook style of books. Certainly, when you have one author, you can keep style consistency a lot easier than you can if you have 20 contributors.
Right. Well, my impression is that this book, regardless of the number of the authors, would always be useful to have in your desk, so you don't have to research much on figuring what is the proven solution or the most recommended solution for problems that sometimes just take an half a dozen lines of code that match. You probably do not need a large library, regardless if you are used to always work with a large library or not. And I think it is recommended for people as like myself that do not work with JavaScript every day. I work with JavaScript often, but not every day. And
me
I
too.
Have always to context switch the context of the language. Sometimes when you do that, you make a syntax confusion. But the use of this book is more to help you finding that the solutions. It it always presents the problems that tries to solve, presents a solution, and then there's a discussion because you want to understand why it is being suggested that solution. But
good, sounds good.
Moving on with our podcast now towards the end of our show. Now we have a section on which we just review a few of the latest updates published in JS Classes site. Michael, have you been looking at the latest objects published there, or what do you think?
I think I have to cough, so just a moment. Okay, I paused or muted, so I didn't do that. The one that I was looking at specifically today.
Hello? Did you mute?
Hello? Oh, I think I muted again.
Okay.
I'm unmuted now. Okay. What I was looking at today was one from a contribution from Gianluca Zanferrari. I hope I'm saying his name correctly. And he's created a message box class that has, it looks like a little bit of, not really animation so much, but there's a little bit of that, but it's a class-oriented approach to displaying message boxes on the screen. Very simple, from what I can tell, but it is that focus on reusable code, and it's very much just a standalone component. Certainly, there's things like this in the jQuerys and the Dojos and the YUIs and so on, but this is very much just a self-contained one file that does that. But I think that really adheres to the focus that you've had for JS classes in the first place.
Right.
Is the focus on reusable code.
Well, when people just have a need for a simple solution that you don't have to bring all the code of a full-fledged library, this is a simple solution that can be can address that kind of need. And in this case, it is very simple, as you mentioned. It basically displays a message that remains on the browser screen for a while. Mm-hmm. And you can configure it to disappear after a short period. It's a very simple, but it addresses a need that you often have to implement in your user interface.
The one thing that jumped out at me here is that it's small enough that you can look at it and figure out what it's doing and go and modify it for yourself. But from somebody that's trying to get a very quick understandable idea of this whole notion of the reusable code and JavaScript and encapsulation, this feels like it kind of hits a mid-ground there.
Right.
Between it's showing somebody something visual and you can get in there and play with it pretty quickly. It's not overwhelming code, but it's usable at the same time.
Right. And following this spirit of implementing very simple things encapsulated in objects, in small objects that you can handpick just to address your needs. There are several others published there recently, and one of them is this JS Paul class that basically also does something simple, which is the management of timers and callbacks that you want to invoke after a certain period of time. And with the additional functionality over a simple set timeout call, which is the ability to stop and resume a timer mm-hmm. for a given period that you may need to pause for a while and avoid calling the registered callback functions. And also another object that also follows the spirit of a simple components, small objects that implement common features that are necessary. There is this one from Rafael Lucio that to build simple menu items that generate menus with links that will pop up when the user clicks on a certain element on the page and show links. So the user can click on links and you can build a very simple menu that you may need in your site very easily. As you mentioned, the spirit of having simple components and simple needs that are common is showing up in the most of the components objects that have been published in the site so far, and over time it is expect to have a very nice collection of independent components that you can pick, and eventually most of them do not require you to load a large library that would probably be more complete and address all the needs. But if you use simple components, you don't need all that to have loaded in your page.
Yeah.
So this is yet another episode of the Lately in JavaScript podcast. Marco, thank you again for your presence, your insights, and
my good looks.
Yeah. Those that appear on audio.
I've got a face for an audio podcast.
Right. Well, that's all for now.
Thanks.